And welcome to the Anime Podcast, the only anarchist podcast to not feature anyone from Oxbridge as a regular host. Today we're going to be talking about the PKK and our season all about armed revolutions, or armed revolutionaries. Some of them good, some of them bad, some of them neutral. Not 100% sure where we're going to fall in the PKK today. Mostly positive at the beginning, I think, and then maybe, as most of the groups that we've discussed so far, tends to go a bit skew-whiff at the end. So, full disclosure for on my end, usually we do a high amount of research, lots of documentaries and podcasts and stuff. But just this week, I am very close to having a baby, and it's just taken up a lot of my time. So I'm not going to be as knowledgeable as I usually am on these things. So if I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, that's because I don't know what I'm talking about, opposed to when I usually don't know what I'm talking about, which just appears that way. So yeah, today...
You should probably just point out that you're not doing Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jr., that you actually have a partner.
You think I'm just gestating a baby on my own, do you?
Well, you didn't. You weren't specific as to... You just said, I'm having a baby. And there's been movies out there. People could be confused.
All right. So you think that our listenership are just... assuming that without the knowledge that there is a partner involved, that it's just like, do you think that our listenership doesn't know how babies are made? Is this what you're implying, Alex?
I mean, have you met anarchists? They definitely don't know how babies are made.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah, you got us there. So as you can hear, is the co-host, Alex. How are you getting on this week, Alex?
Fine. I should also point out you probably pissed off Cenk Uygur because you said something that remotely could be viewed as kind of something that the Turks don't like. Since the TOIT guy, you know, you guys know Cenk Uygur, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I have to dunk on him as a Turkish person.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Fucking pain in the ass. Doesn't even acknowledge the Armenian genocide happened, which is always fun. And from what I've heard, not a big fan of the PKK. So we've lost him.
Yeah, and as you can already hear, we have the very beautiful Shannon Koss. Who are you and I?
I'm good. Also, I should just say, because everyone does their own pronunciation. It's Sinan. It's
Sinan.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
I mean, I've only known you for what, 3 or 4 years? So
yeah, I know, it's super weird. But yeah, I'm good. I just got done with a stream, so I'm a bit manic right now because it was an intense one, having to deal with many crusades. So. Yeah, I'm good.
This is in Crusader Kings.
Yeah, Crusader Kings 3. This is not, I have not just bizarrely been taken up defending the Holy Land for whatever reason.
Yeah, I'm not sure how up our listenership are on Crusader Kings. As far as we know, they're not part of the shitpost community. They tend to be very disparate across the UK and America for some reason. So I'm not sure how caught up they are on their game stuff. So, right. Let's get into it anyway. So, yeah, as previously stated, we're talking about the PKK, who are a Kurdish armed revolutionary group, mostly in Turkey, partly in Iraq and Iran. They are armed. There's a very famous video of them shooting down a Turkish helicopter with a heat-seeking missile. It's pretty cool. I'd advise going to watch it if you get the chance. And we'll probably put that in the show notes to give you an idea of what their propaganda looks like. But let's start from the very start. So who are the PKK and what was their origins effectively?
Well, I'd just like to tell a really brief story, which I think is funny. It's very brief. I'm not like normally brief with me, which is not brief. When I was a kid, I went to see my uncle. My uncle moved to Turkey in the early 90s and married a Turkish woman, has Turkish kids. And I didn't know very much at the time about Turkey. And I picked up this book which was like a comic book history of Turkey. And it was just from like Ataturk onwards. And my only reference to Kurds was the occasional image where after Ataturk had come to power. And it was like, Ataturk dealt with the rebels. And it was just an image of him. And in the background, these people hanging from gallows. And I was like, oh, okay. So they must, Kurds must mean criminals. And then years and years and years later, when I actually was not a child and actually looked stuff up, I was like, ooh. So if you're listening to this and you're in Turkey, probably don't know very much about the reality of where the PKK came from, or at least, or indeed the average life of a Kurdish person. And it was a very surprising. My uncle and my cousins don't share many of my views on this because they are pretty indoctrinated. But yeah, no, the PKK came out of the Kurdish Workers' Party came out of basically Marxist-Leninist communist movement in the 70s, very, very heavily influenced by one man, Abdullah, I'm going to butcher the name, Öcalan.
Yeah.
And he kind of, until he was, probably still to this day, but certainly until he was arrested and captured and arrested in 1999, was kind of their guru. I mean, he had enormous influence and still is, as a figurehead, enormously influential. But in terms of day-to-day and what they believed and what they did, hugely influential until he was captured and still is very, very influential. But they were originally a Marxist-Leninist group that sought a nation state for the Kurdish people, not just in southeastern Turkey, but basically the historic greater Kurdistan. And while initially they kind of kept their activities quite quiet, in 1984, basically declared war on the Turkish state, and a guerrilla war began in the southeastern mountains of Turkey that continues to this very day. That basic introduction to who they are.
Yeah, I'd say that about covers a lot of it. I would say that for the PKK, if you're looking at like deep origin stories, a lot of the PKK's radicalism emerged in the 60s, in the 60s student leftist movement in Turkey. But obviously they ended up having to do kind of a separate movement for themselves on account of this general problem with Turkish leftism, which is that it never really reckons with Turkish nationalism. And before 1991, it was pretty much illegal to be Kurdish. Like, you couldn't acknowledge the existence of Kurdish people without getting in some kind of trouble. So that's pretty much the atmosphere in which this separate leftist movement came out from. Otherwise, they would have been part of, like, Devgench, Revolutionary Youth, and stuff like that, and Devyal later. Although, if there wasn't this sort of constant problem in Turkish leftism with just not dealing with the nationalism question.
So why specifically, then? Because it is important, I think, to some extent, to point out that it is got like the Turkish and the Turkish government and the PKK do have it's got an ethnic tension towards it. And you know, there's quite a few episodes that we've done so far where, you know, this is a running theme with what creates the bedrock for armed militants to have, you know, we talked about Hamas and then the indigenous people of the EZLN. So what specifically, why does the Turkish state hate Kurds so much, and why are they, you know, basically genocidal towards them?
Well, can I come in here just to say one thing, which is it's not just the Kurds. Talk to the Armenians for 5 minutes, or for indeed for many other people. Without going too much into it, because it's a really long history, you have to go back to the late 19th, early 20th century. Turkish nationalism comes out of the Young Turks movement. Again, another stupid reason to call your online news source the Young Turks. But anyway, Anatolia is a land of many different people of Greek, Armenian kind of origin. You could be here all day to go into the history. But the idea of there being a Turkish people who are all the same kind of emerged around the same time it was in the rest of Europe. And certainly it becomes particularly genocidal when it comes to the Armenians, who were Christian. I think they were the largest Christian group within the Ottoman Empire that becomes Turkey. And the view that they were, because they were Christian, had to be extirpated, and were extirpated to the tune of about 1.5 million people in World War One. That's kind of the roots of the particular hatred for groups that don't fit into the mold of being Turkish. So until 1991, the Kurds are called Mountain Turks. Their language is not acknowledged, it's banned, their music is banned, their folklore is banned, their history is banned. And it's because it's driven by this kind of bizarre and just single-minded view that everyone is Turkish and they have to be Turkish. If they're not Turkish, we got to get rid of them in some fashion.
Yeah, so that's kind of, there are kind of two waves of Turkish nationalism. So you have like the Young Turks wave of nationalism, which comes out, really begins in like 1876-ish, which is when the first like big acts of ethnic cleansing start happening in the Ottoman Empire. Then you have like the 1920s wave of nationalism, which was sort of the secular nationalist movement of Ataturk. And so the idea there was you're creating a new identity, right? Because the idea of a cohesive Turkish identity in Anatolia just doesn't exist, right? It didn't exist, barely exists now. But like you can create a cohesive identity amongst like, you know, Turkish language speaking people. So that's like the west of Turkey, central Turkey, northern Turkey, kind of. But then you encounter these people in the southeast who are not Turkish. They don't speak Turkish in their day-to-day lives. And so you look like a foreign occupier to them, which, you know, you are essentially. And because your nationalist project is predicated on the idea of everyone within these borders are Turks, you end up causing friction. Friction starts happening. And so that's where you get the first rebellion, major rebellion against Ataturk in 1928, I want to say, which was brutally put down. Like the comic book with the hanging glosses over the level of brutality done in that particular, in response to that rebellion. But yeah, you saw it from the very beginning of the Turkish Republic when they tried to pursue their supposedly civic nationalist project. Of course, it didn't stay civic nationalist for very long. But yeah, especially in the atmosphere of the 20s, there was a lot of unacknowledged fascist influence in that particular nationalist project that was being built.
Right. That's fairly comprehensive. I'm quite, that's a good sort of lead into it. So we know, you know, you've got these ethnic tensions, and then you've got basically some tensions coming from the Cold War in Turkey. You know, where you know, looking at the map, obviously, you know, it's so close to Russia, it's the gateway to the east for a lot of places. It's obviously always going to be in the Cold War scenario, it's going to have a lot of influences trying to put in different directions. So the, you know, the Kurdistan Workers Party, they've got these Marxist ideology, they sort of come out of the sort of like student protest scene. So what is the catalyst then that sort of makes them become armed?
Well, there was a military coup in, one of the many military coups in 1980, and the, what's the best way to put it, because it's always been a bit authoritarian, but let's just say the military junta became particularly interested in kind of repressing expressions of Kurdish separatism, culture, and the group that was already there, the Kurdish Workers Party, kind of were able to feed off that in terms of people joining the movement, in terms of a confrontation with the state. I think there was also a change to the constitution in 83 or so, which again further kind of disenfranchised Kurds. And so there was the groundswell of support for someone who's going to fight for a Kurdish state, or at the very least some type of autonomy that guaranteed the ethnic or identity rights and kind of civil rights. And out of that comes the declaration of war in 84. I mean, that's what I know of it so far. I'm sure you can tell us more.
Yes. Yeah, so the coup in 1980, led by Kenan Evren, who would become president of Turkey, was probably a big catalyst for a lot of violence in Turkey. Really, the 1960 coup also ignited the low-level left-right violence that triggered the 1980 coup. But 1980 really pushed a lot of groups into just actively being violent, including the PKK, because they just had nothing to lose at that point, because you're going to get arrested either way. And being arrested at that time in Turkey was not good. It's not good in general, but it was particularly bad at that point. And I have a story about the 1983 referendum to change the constitution, which was they basically had like yes to change the constitution with a big circle and no with a small circle, and they would have a soldier in the booth with you. And I think it's my dad who went in, looked the soldier in the eye, and stamped no. And there were only like 8% of people voted no in that situation, because obviously it was not a free or fair vote, as you might imagine, if they have a soldier standing in the booth with you. But yeah, the 1984 declaration of war, I think was in response to specific was in response to the 1983 election as well, because that's when Turgut Özal, who himself was of Kurdish origin, he was leading the Motherland Party, if I'm recalling the name correctly. And they were basically a right-wing nationalist, but they posed as liberal kind of... It's the kind of party that a lot of people in the political center in the UK would support in Latin America, but they were explicitly very racist in their policies because they had to do what the junta said, basically. The military president would lean on them and be like, no, you can't let language rights exist for these people. You have to come down on them. And there were lots of heavy-handed responses to just protests and stuff like that. And so people seem to have come to the conclusion that, well, if the state's going to fight us, we may as well try and fight back against the state.
And from my understanding, they have to move out of Turkey and they go to, is it Lebanon? I'm thinking.
Syria.
Syria, yeah.
You go to Syria because from 70, I think he's fairly pretty fucking early, Hafez al-Assad, who was the current Assad's dad, in fact, far more effective in butchering people and keeping everyone under control. He, for some reason, was happy enough to let them base themselves on his side of the border, his part of Kurdistan, and to let them kind of train, to let them have camps there. I think Öcalan was interviewed there in 95 or so by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. That's one of the videos I was able to find online. So yeah, they once, you know, the Turkish army goes in and once you basically have an initial period of guerrilla war, they had to get out of there. It's just too much, too large an army, because the Turkish army is, I think, the second largest army in NATO.
Yes, second largest.
Which an enormous kind of air force. So while they had certain advantages in the mountains, you're not going to be able to openly organize in the same way. So I think since the late 80s, they've had their main bases in, first in Syria, now in northern Iraq, and they have kind of forward bases in Turkish Kurdistan, if you will, where they mount operations, but they don't have any major infrastructure there.
Yeah, it's worth, if you're not really familiar with Middle Eastern politics, that the sort of Kurdistan idea of Kurdistan and like where, you know, Kurds tend to live goes through a whole bunch of countries in the Middle East. And that's sort of important, I think, to their continued existence because they're not bottled into one specific area. So the next thing we kind of want to move on to is, you know, the main reason that we're kind of talking about them is because, you know, they've been going for however long, since the 80s, and they definitely started with a Marxist ideology. So what I want to know is how important that was to them in the early days, you know, when they're training in Syria, like, what is their commitment to Marxist ideas? And exactly who was training them at that time as well?
The Marxism element of it was very important at the start. It's kind of strange with the Kurds in Turkey and Turkish Kurdistan, because they're not people who you would typically think were receptive to a Marxist message. But it was important for them to be seen to be fighting, and the Marxist-Leninist element of it was important because it got them links with other Turkish leftist groups who were also fighting the state. So there have been two separate 50-year-long people's wars led by Maoist communist groups in Turkey, both of which have links and relations with the PKK, because they both just sort of have the common enemy of overthrowing the Turkish state. Makes sense. But as time has gone on, and you can kind of see this in the alleged political wings of the PKK that were active in Turkey. So now it's the HDP that is alleged to be their political wing. When their ideological commitment is definitely left of center, whether it's Marxist-Leninist, you know, and there are obviously obviously a lot of Kurdish groups are explicitly left-wing, libertarian socialist of that sort. And what was it? It was who was training them? Who was training and arming them? So that That's kind of complicated. That's like a Cold War laced question right there. Arms have just been smuggled to them, basically. I think they had camps in Greece. They had camps in Cyprus. They've had camps in Syria, Iraq. The Soviet Union obviously supplied them with quite a lot of their, or at least the weapons originated in the Soviet Union. Probably can't quite trace it that directly.
Czechoslovakia, but, oddly enough.
Yeah, Czechoslovakia too, which always puzzled me, but maybe it was for like an arm's length kind of deal. But
the Czechoslovakia also armed the Red Brigades in the 70s too, so it's not unusual.
Yeah. Damn, those Czechs. But yeah, they I think they did training with the PLO even, like in Palestine. I think they've also done training with them. Obviously, like other Turkish leftist groups have bases in mountains in Turkey. There's obviously been some joint training with them, I would imagine.
The Greeks, Greeks,
yeah. You know, Greece used to have quite a lot of militant leftist groups, and they definitely have had camps in Greece. That has more or less been confirmed by everyone at this point. And obviously, Greece is like, we would never let that. And but obviously, that is what's happened. And this is kind of a difficult question to parse, sort of Turkish saber rattling from what actually happened, because Turkey believes everyone and anyone who antagonizes it at any time has funded the PKK, even if they've explicitly like declared them an enemy. They think so, you know, they've accused America of funding them. They've accused Russia, earlier the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union definitely did do it. I think they've accused Britain of doing it, Switzerland, the Netherlands. Yeah, there's a long list of people Turkey believes are arming them. But
Öcalan said during his trial that the Greeks did help. I think that was one of the few people he fingered. Again, whether that was just to have fun, who knows?
Yeah, I think that was probably because you got to remember at the time of his trial, Turkey had just abolished the death penalty in order to get him extradited originally, but he'd escaped that and then had to be arrested later. And there was a big push in Turkey to get the death penalty back if he wasn't being cooperative. And so he might have felt inclined not to be executed by the Turkish state, which I think is a fair enough reaction given how furious people were in the late 90s about it, especially because that was kind of a peak in the violence in a lot of ways. Although, of course, there was but then at the end of the 90s, you get the ceasefire. So everything had kind of fizzled out at that point. But yeah, I'm not sure who else funds it. Well, I know one of the ways they get funded actually, or are alleged to get funded, is from sort of Kurdish community groups in the diaspora.
I just remembered the obvious thing that one of the biggest controversial points is that there's quite a lot of evidence, depending on who you're willing to listen to, that they are involved in drug smuggling. Now, again, they say that's not true. Öcalan was being interviewed in the 90s and said, you know, if these people are doing this, why haven't you caught them yet? Which is not a great answer to, are you drug smuggling? You know, like, what? If they exist, go catch them, you know? So I think there's probably some degree of truth to it there. But then again, the IRA did the same thing. A lot of groups have done the same thing to fund their operations. I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying, you know, if they're getting some hash or some fucking weed or whatever through, that's one thing. But there is some evidence that they may have been involved in getting heroin out of Afghanistan into Europe. So there's some evidence they did that. And again, if you believe Interpol and you believe some of these groups, Americans have labeled them, some of their representatives, as narco traffickers. So it was at least some of the money they used to arm themselves came from probably drug trafficking, sorry.
Yeah, I would suspect that's quite common to any group that has a large amount of weapons in Turkey. I would imagine that doesn't excuse it. Again, it's just, it is a done thing, as I understand it. But yeah, there are community groups in the Kurdish diaspora who are accused of collecting funds for them. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. Not, you know.
So there's kind of two things that I want to get into here. You know, part of the reason that we've been doing this season is to, one, just, you know, get an idea of the history of these groups. But it's also like, you know, what can you learn from them? What's good, what's bad? You know, sometimes we can be very critical of the groups that we're talking about. Other times we're neutral, other times we're quite praising. of their methods. Now, with the Tamil Tigers, they were almost exclusively funded through the diaspora, especially, you know, in the UK. And so you have what was effectively an army. It's the only sort of like, you know, as we were saying on that podcast, it's the only one of that sort of armed group that actually had boats and an air force. Now, it wasn't a very impressive air force, but still, it's more than most have. So, you know, if it's possible to fund an army like that, surely it's possible to fund other stuff. You know, it's possible to fund a newspaper, it's possible to fund, you know, something like Acorn or the IWW. And so what I kind of want to get across to, you know, people listening to the podcast following us through the season is that there is an ability, if the left just puts its hand into its pocket, to fund stuff, to actually have a functioning left that can actually achieve aims. Now, I'm obviously not saying that what we need to be doing in, you know, the UK and Ireland is, you know, picking up AK-47s and fighting a guerrilla war against the state, though I'm obviously not completely against that as an idea. But what I am saying is that, you know, if we were interested, we would be able to fund groups that would potentially work outside of the party political system. And I think, you know, part of the reason that I wanted to talk about the PKK was that reason, is that they've been going for so long being funded by these methods. So Alex, you've got a direct response to that.
I do, because I think, kind of jumping off your point, something we also kind of noticed with the various groups is that some of them have done that, have had a social program whereby they were like, okay, we're going to, even Hamas famously described as, you know, by one person, that's Al-Qaeda with bin collections. You know, there are groups that have a social side, a social contract, and try and build something. And then there's groups that don't. The Red Brigades we did last week had none of that. You know, very, you know, barely had a base at all. Zapatista have built schools, they built municipal legislatures from local government all the way up to regional assemblies. And in, if you consider what has happened with the YPG in Rojava, they've created an entire, you know, decentralized kind of very libertarian, socialist, anarchist kind of society there, depending on who you believe, you know. That's what I choose to believe anyway. And a lot of that is something that, you know, the left can fail to do, that it basically becomes wedded to parliamentarianism, and they say, oh, we have to get fucking Jeremy Corbyn elected, or we have to get Bernie Sanders, if you consider Bernie Sanders left, you know, etc., etc. And they just, they kind of, or they engage in navel gazing, you know, like some of the structuralists in the 60s and 70s walking around Paris going, yes, geography, yes. So I do think there's something to be said for the left does have a lot of power to do things, and there's a lot of really good examples that already exist, and we've touched upon them. And I think with the PKK, what they created, they have their own newspapers, they have their own propaganda on TV and radio. They were able, their sister group, if you consider them a sister group in Rojava, were able to do rather remarkable things in really shitty circumstances. And the fact that the left in the West, quotation marks, doesn't do any of those things, but often spends all of its time bitching and moaning on Facebook comment threads, says a lot, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, the PKK have definitely built up quite a presence. So I mentioned the HDP, which is alleged to be their political wing. They deny it, and they should deny it. And there's currently a trial in Turkey to close the party because of these alleged links. So, which, I mean, the Turkey's done that before, they'll do it again, and it won't solve the problem. But they also have regional parties that do, because regional governments in Turkey have quite a lot of leeway and power compared to regional, like local governments in the UK. So there's the example of the communist mayor in Tunceli, who basically made public transport free and redistributed land to the farmers. Great, right? But you can do that. That's the level of power you have. And they started running their sort of southeastern mayoralties in a much more sort of what we would see as sort of like a democratic socialist-y kind of way, But obviously then the Turkish state intervenes and dismisses the mayors and puts in their own cronies. And so it's all run the way they expect. But they also, I remember their newspaper. It's called Horehun or something like that. It means liberation in Kurdish. And yeah, it's a good paper. It's a very well-made paper. It's surprising given how marginalized the group is, how few members, active members, it seems to have in the core group. Because it only has maybe 10,000 at most in the core group of the PKK. It's kind of remarkable how much they can do just because they have buy-in from a lot of people in southeastern Turkey who are willing to stick their neck out in these other groups to just kind of do the active things that they can't do on account of being in the mountains in northern Iraq, essentially being picked off bit by Turkish drones.
But yeah, I imagine like any group in the UK that had 10,000 members would just be jumping with joy with that. You know, I think the only people that maybe come close to that, and they're not even anywhere close to being the left, is something like Extinction Rebellion. You know, they're pushing a couple of thousand of that, and you know, the Labour Party obviously under Corbyn had a good chunk, but I don't know if like ACORN or IWW or the Anarchist Federation or the Socialist Workers Party, anyone like that has close to 10,000.
It might be 5, it might be 10. Obviously, numbers are hard to gauge with a group that is explicitly banned in so many places. So because no one's waving their membership card around, because that would be a rather foolish move, I would suspect, in some parts of the world. But yeah, I was just thinking, yeah, because you mentioned like the Labour Party having a big chunk. There's the thing is, then you're subordinating yourself to a structure then. So numbers were nice, just didn't make a difference, I don't think.
Yeah, that was very clear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was nice, but you know, what can you do? You're in a structure. You can't necessarily break it from within.
So the next thing I kind of want to get onto is, before we sort of move on to how the war on terror has really affected them from the 2000s onward, was here's where the tricky stuff starts coming in, because basically most of these groups that we're talking about this season, even if we are genuinely in favor of them, they are not without sin. And you know, I think partly we could say that's because, you know, war isn't pretty. You know, these people are, you know, fighting wars, and sometimes it's called war when it's a ceasefire, but other times it's actually an open war. And I think, you know, one of the other things that we've been trying to get through this season is that sometimes it's kind of important to forego your morals when it comes to winning, to some extent. You know, there's obviously hard lines in that, but you know, the PKK are accused of running drugs. Now that I'm neither here nor there about, I don't give a shit. I think, you know, if they're going to make money from that, and I think, you know, that's a conversation for another podcast. Where my worry does come from is the accusation that they use child soldiers. And female brigades, fine with as well. I think, you know, they're perfectly acceptable. But is it, from your knowledge, do they actually use child soldiers, or is that just propaganda against them?
That's debated, much like it's debated whether they have anything to do with human trafficking or whether they have... Well, it's not debated that there has been like a few suicide bombings, not many. I mean, obviously, by comparison to the Tamil Tigers, it's not a huge amount. Quite often, the Turkish government will lump groups like ISIS, who they actively supported with money, and pretty they bought their fucking oil anyway. They'll say, oh, you know, we have a lot of terrorism and the PKK is the worst or whatever. But there are some examples of that which are not, you know, which are solid in terms of they happened. So I would say, much like with the Tamils, you know, I don't see how that benefits you in any way. It's certainly, again, while the Tamils targeted lots of different people, including Zengali's kind of military infrastructure, it seemed like most of the time with the PKK that they again targeted military rather than civilians. Civilians were killed in the process. But yeah, I don't think that helps build a good reputation for yourself. Certainly, it's easy to then use that against you. The same with human trafficking. I don't know enough about whether that's true, and there's not as much solid information about that as with the drug trafficking. Child soldiers, there's a lot of teenagers who seem to have found their way into the PKK and seem to be at various points frontline soldiers. They have said recently that they do not let people under the age of 16 join, and anyone who is over the age of 16 to 18 are not put in military positions. I would not necessarily believe that, because they have a big problem with getting people into the organization. It's a very, very dangerous line of work. So yeah, it depends whether you want to, whether you think that they are keeping their word about that. But certainly in the past, they seem to have used teenagers who we would call children, and I don't think that helps in any way, to be honest with you.
Yeah, they've almost certainly used child soldiers, but just because in Turkey there's in Turkey generally, a lot of people from rural backgrounds, poorer backgrounds, will find their way into these groups because they, one, believe in a cause, two, there isn't much for them at home. You got the southeast of Turkey is probably by some margin the poorest region of Turkey. Chronic and deliberate underdevelopment has probably been a factor in these young people trying to make their way into the PKK. And yeah, I don't think the PKK have necessarily kept their word about 16 to 18 year olds not being on the front line, but the Turkish state has an active interest in sort of underestimating the age of people, because, you know, what's the difference between someone who looks 19 and 17 as a young lad in the mountains in Turkey or Iraq or wherever? It's hard to identify because they don't exactly take their ID papers with them. And so, definitely doesn't help. And this is obviously a thing with like having, just 5,000 or just 10,000 people in your core group when you're fighting the second largest military in NATO. Like, you might well be inclined to take whoever you can get, and you might well think, well, if you're old enough to find your way into the mountains in northern Iraq, you're old enough to hold the gun, are you old enough to go at the front line? Seems to be the calculation there.
And also, it should be said that about 2,000, probably more now, villages and towns have been ethnically cleansed effectively by the Turkish state of Kurds. So there's a lawful, and in northern Iraq, they bomb the shit out of any Kurdish village they can get away with, and many of those they can't get away with, but somehow manage to get away with it anyway. So there's a lot of people who would flock to the banners who might also lie about what age they are, or are so angry they take them as an impassioned volunteer, you know?
Oh, definitely. There's definitely, you can go to southeastern Turkey and see completely abandoned villages. And so you can see the ethnic cleansing for yourself. They don't hide it. They don't hide it down there. They let you waltz into the villages sometimes. And there are many abandoned villages, well, abandoned, forcibly cleansed villages that people abandoned. And so there is an active, angry baseline populace there who will. And even there are stories, I don't know if this is true, there are stories of people encouraging their kids to go to the mountains to join to fight because they're too old or they have too many, things tying them down in an area. So entirely plausible that this is, people are lying, people are sending their kids. Entirely plausible.
So let's move things on a little bit then, because where the PKK have really had a problem, and they're sort of like, on their two fronts, basically, is after the Twin Towers, there's this heightened sense of, suddenly every government is running to declare their enemies terrorists. And, a lot of the people that we're talking about in this season suddenly find themselves in a very different scenario than they are when they started with it. Tamil Tiger has probably been another example of a group that suddenly have gone from being, an ethnic military actor in a civil war to suddenly being a terrorist group. Now, obviously, I think Turkey was always counting the PKK as a terrorist group, but in some places in the world, it was a bit more nuanced. But suddenly you've got, the UN, obviously Britain was always interested in having them as terrorists as well, but how has this affected their outcome, Alex?
I think it's actually I mean, there's a lot of different things happening around that time, the trial of Ocalan and stuff. But I think in a weird way, they responded quite cleverly. Whether that was his doing or not is probably heavily about his influence. But they kind of started to drop the demands for a nation state. They started more kind of focusing on having feminism as a pillar of their ideology. They shifted away from Marxist-Leninism towards kind of libertarian socialism. The idea of the state, that they wanted to transform, certainly the southeast of Turkey, but hopefully Turkey, you know, in the Middle East in general, that kind of began. And the kind of an attempt really to differentiate themselves from the kind of popular perception of terrorists, certainly Sunni Muslim terrorists in quotation marks. So yeah, I think that kind of helped them to a certain degree. There was a very long ceasefire as well. I think maybe two ceasefires, 1990 to 2004, and then another one from until 2013 to 2015. So there was long periods to kind of reorganize themselves, and also some degree of safety in northern Iraq. But yeah, they obviously had to learn to adapt to the new reality, whereby there was going to be a lot less money, a lot less support coming if they just continue down the same old road. And they were able to adapt. And I think, to be honest with you, now, despite the huge problems of the Turkish military, their incursions, invasions of Rojava, invasions of Afrin, I think it is. And as well as just continual bombings across the border, which is a fucking war crime, that they have been able to gain a huge amount of support across Greater Kurdistan by having a revolutionary kind of, you know, libertarian socialist model, because they can now say, well, no, this is what we want to do, and we're not, you know, we are clearly very, very different from the Daesh, the kind of the ISIS, the whatever of the world. So they may have been the only group I can think of that responded very well to how the war on terror changed things in the 2000s.
Yeah, definitely. They like was said, they definitely adapted the ideology. They stepped back from some of the hardcore Marxism. They kind of started doing that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, as a lot of groups started to do, because it seemed like Marxism Leninism is sort of like an animating force was pretty much done. So everyone had to kind of find their own way to sort of animate people to their side. And you kind of see it in their political wings, this sort of shift, because you've ended up now with the HDP, who are now, you know, they're pro LGBTQ rights. They're feminist. They're a feminist party. They're a very socially liberal party, as well as being a left-wing democratic socialist party, at least self-identified as. So like you kind of see it, as opposed to their earlier groups who were like extremely regionalist, Kurdish issues only, southeast of Turkey only, kind of mentality that they had. Now the HDP, you know, they win votes in every province of Turkey. They win a significant number. They may not win seats, but they do win a significant number of votes in parts of Turkey that you didn't see these parties even consider running in the past. So there's sort of a now all Turkey kind of feel to it, especially with a bit more openness with working with other Turkish left-wing groups, because they sort of joined this umbrella organization that has one of the best logos I've ever seen. I've forgotten the name of it, but it's basically an alliance of like revolutionary socialist and communist groups that explicitly want to overthrow the government. But you would never have seen that alliance pre-war on terror at all. There would never have been such an explicit alliance, broad front, if you will, like this.
It also helps that Erdogan is just a giant piece of shit, and so many people fucking despise him.
Yeah, he very specifically burned the Kurds as well, because they were a big part of his electoral coalition. So at the start of the AKP government, there was that one of their big things was like, well, why don't we simply stop discriminating against Kurdish people? And obviously that won them a lot of votes in Turkish Kurdistan. And it was purely an electoral move. And it was also kind of a signal to what we would call sort of liberal voters that it's okay to vote for us. We're not like the old parties who are going to keep this ridiculous state of affairs going. We're a new party. We're going to renew Turkey. We're going to have this big, you know, wonderful thing where everyone's welcome. Obviously that didn't work out. But yeah, so and actually Erdogan specifically burning the like the bridges with Kurdish people has probably led to a lot of the better adaptations from the PKK, because they had to react to the changing political landscape in Turkey, because suddenly there was a big group of people up for grabs that maybe perhaps weren't before.
I think one of the other things that's interesting from the fallout from the war of terror is, you know, the creation of ISIS, and mostly ISIS for them, but they're suddenly fighting a different enemy as well. And so then you end up in the, you know, in papers like The Guardian, seeing, you know, these journalists trying to do these acrobatics in their head, where they're basically, you know, still trying to hold the line that the PKK are bad, but also the ISIS are bad. And you can just see like the upset and the confusion as they're trying to, you know, they're so used to being like good and bad. And so to them, they're like, you know, they can't even put it in terms of like, oh, well, they're both as bad as each other, because that's not how they've been taught how to construct a journalistic argument. So I think that's like really when they sort of came to my attention as a group. Was, you know, I'm not sure if it was Dan Hodges, but it was definitely someone like him, just like, you know, jumping through these mental hoops to get to this point. So kind of the last question then, and obviously with these ones it's very, very difficult to answer, but as things are falling at the moment, where do we think that the Kurdistan Workers Party is going to go in the next 5 to 10 years or so? What's looking good for them? What's looking bad?
I mean, the tactics they're employing in terms of kind of focusing heavily on feminism, on libertarian socialism, it has gained them a lot of support. It also has the advantage, if done correctly, of giving people in local municipalities actual control over their life, at least some control. I think that's far more likely to build an even larger base, as it already has, of support. But you have a huge fucking problem, which is the Turkish government. As long as, I mean, it's not even just Erdogan, because Erdogan's only been around for like 20 years. And we all obviously know this is a much, much older problem, as we've already discussed in the episode. As long as Turkey, and Turkey is where like 2/3 or half the Kurdish population live, and where PKK are fighting its most violent battle, and even when they're based in northern Syria, the fucking Turks follow them there, and are based in northern Iraq, they fucking follow them there too. So, I mean, they have a huge fucking problem, which is that as long as Turks are of the view that everyone needs to be Turkish, or at the very least the unity of the state cannot be challenged in any way, as long as that kind of a large percentage of the population think that way, they're going to have a huge problem, because they've been fighting this war for 40 years, at least 40,000 people have died. We were talking about ethnic cleansing. The PKK do not have the ability to defeat the Turkish army militarily. They just don't. In the same way that the IRA didn't against the British army. They, you know, at best, you might hope for, you know, might get a stalemate, but even that's going to, you know, it's quite difficult. And the Turkish, kind of the reactionary segment of the Turkish population, don't seem interested in compromising at all. So unless there's some type of change in a significant section of the population that are at the very least accepting that, you know, Kurds should have the right to their own culture, to their own identity, to their own municipal, local, regional government, then I don't know if there's going to be much difference in the future than there has been in the past. The best the PKK can do is continue with the type of revolutionary ideas, because that's more likely to appeal to sections of the Turkish population who may not, you know, be tremendously thrilled with the idea of Kurdish independence. And they might be able to build a coalition, as we were talking about there. But this is a struggle that's far from over. It's going to take a significantly long time for them, in my opinion, to even achieve something like that, because Turkey is a very, very conservative and large section of the population is quite reactionary. I mean, all societies have their reactionary parts, but in terms of just refusing to accept the rights of ethnic minorities, Turkey is one of the worst in that I can think of anyway.
Yeah, what happens next is it it kind of does depend on what happens at the next election. It kind of doesn't. So the likely outcome of the next election, assuming everything is free, fair, there's no interference, so big heaping helpfuls assault when you fit with this analysis, is that Erdogan will lose in a runoff and will lose quite badly to a main opposition candidate from the Republican People's Party. And the Republican People's Party are the party that founded the Turkish state and, you know, the Atatürk's party, right? So there is a very significant old guard reactionary component to that party. So even if you get the situation where the opposition alliance, which is a center-left to far-right alliance, and it blows my mind that that's the alliance that is apparently the great hope, but there it is. It is, even if we get the situation where they need to be propped up by the HDP to govern, which is not unlikely, but the HDP needs to get into parliament and not be banned before that election, you will probably see every single dirty trick in the book pulled out to try and prevent any kind of move towards reconciliation. You'll see, you know, party splits. You'll see the military start, you know, umming and ahhing about, is it time for another rare intervention, if you in the style of Tony Blair, into the affairs of the democratic process. But the PKK do have that the ideology element going for them. They are very good at adapting to the changing political landscape in Turkey, in Kurdish society as well, because we mentioned like Turkey being a deeply conservative society. The Kurds in Turkish Kurdistan are also a deeply conservative society as well in a lot of ways, and yet they've managed to find cut through with them, maybe not with like active support, but like even at the ballot box begrudgingly supporting a party that opposes almost all of their social views, is impressive that they've managed to be a part of that. And so really what happens kind of depends on whether the next president of Turkey, whoever that may be, and whoever the parliamentary leader of their support will be, is clever enough or capable enough to just kind of face down these forces that have dictated Turkish politics in the past. It's going to be a long time. I don't think the next government of Turkey, whoever that may be, will be where this is resolved. It might be the one after, you know, the one after this one, basically. It's going to be a long process, and it's going to require a lot of pain, political pain, in the Turkish segment of the society. And unfortunately, it's going to require a lot of like pain, perhaps, in the Kurdish segment of the society there as well.
Just one last thing, which is that it should be only a couple of sentences, which is, as long as large sections of the Turkish population cannot accept what they did to the Armenian people, which they don't under any circumstance, and in fact arm the Azerbaijanis to kill fucking Armenian people as they recently did, I don't see how they're ever going to be able to deal with something in the present. This is a genocide that happened over 100 years ago. They can't accept that. They won't accept that. They go have a fucking tantrum whenever it's mentioned. They have their thugs beating up Armenians outside the fucking White House, which they did a couple of years ago. As long as they can't deal with something 100 years ago plus, they're not going to be able to deal with the legitimate civil rights abuses and repression of the Kurds. Simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a Hearts of Iron stream, which is a game where you play in World War II, and I played as Turkey, and I did a big talk about like early Republican history in Turkey. And I had a lot of Turkish viewers for that, and they genuinely were puzzled as to why I said that Turkey needs to kind of face up to this past. And it's like, you're not going to solve any of the problems in Turkey today unless you can figure out how to sort of actually approach this issue with anything even remotely close to the level of seriousness it actually deserves to be treated with. And there are elements of Turkish society across parties, except like the far right parties, who briefly inched towards some kind of process that maybe could have been okay, but then they pulled away from it. You know, just there, it was too much. And it just doesn't seem like it's going to be something they can deal with anytime soon, unfortunately.
I guess my closing thought on what would potentially is going to happen in the future, and I really hope that I'm kind of wrong on this one. I mean, I think you're both definitely right. It's going to take a long time to play out. But as per with the Middle East of the past, 80, possibly 100 years now, is what is America going to do? What fucking insane shit are they cooking up right now? Is obviously going to, I think, it always has that ripple effect through the region. And I just currently don't know where Biden is sitting on these things. And I'm half expecting him to maybe sort of lose interest in the Middle East and start focusing back more onto, you know, South America, which seems to be where some of their, you know, attention is being focused. And obviously they're big enough to focus in many different places, but it's difficult to create a narrative that exists in more than a couple of places. So
just to say, the Russians matter too, because they're the ones fucking propping up Assad, and they're also the one that want to have a good relationship with the Turks. And unfortunately, those are the two countries that are the most important in terms of the Kurdish people. The Americans are in Iraq. They're not going anywhere, I don't think, this time. But unfortunately, the Russians are in Syria like a fucking tick. And they're not, if they decide to just have, you know, Assad and Erdogan or whoever replaces them shake hands over the fucking dead bodies of the Kurds, I could absolutely see them doing that, you know?
Yeah. So that's us for that episode. Maybe we should I don't want to end there, because I think they're actually, you know, the PKK are probably a lot more positive to look at than maybe we were initially thinking at the beginning of the episode. So here's our closing thoughts then. What do we think that we can learn from them? What's good that we can take as, you know, leftist projects when it comes to our own struggles?
I mentioned earlier that the Kurdish society in southeastern Turkey is a quite conservative component of that society. And there is this, you know, the culture war. It's the culture war, the hated culture war, right? But this party and these groups have managed to get cut through despite not holding those particular views. I think there's an element of actually being brave and standing by people who we should be standing by. And that will get us a lot of credit. And one of the other things is actually trying to organize and, you know, building our own media, right? It's difficult. Of course it's difficult, but building our own media, building our own sort of organizations that can actually provide support to people, because, you know, like 80% of people, maybe 99% of people, they don't really give a shit about it beyond like, what have you done for me lately? Right. But they manage to do something for people lately and it pays off. It doesn't pay off immediately and it's still a long struggle, but you can get things done maybe in ways that you don't expect. And that's probably something that should be learned from a lot of groups, but PKK in particular seem to cover those bases quite nicely.
My view would be, I agree what you said there, but I would say with them, one of the strengths and what the left never does is really lean into the positive elements of kind of cultural identity. So they encouraged Kurdish language, culture, folklore, music. They very much embraced that when, certainly obviously in the 70s and 80s and 90s they did, but even now that they're moving towards more kind of libertarian, have moved toward libertarian socialist position, they, you know, most of their support and most of the support of the YPG are still Kurds. And the kind of the power of that kind of way of talking, communicating, the possession of a narrative about the Kurdish, Greater Kurdistan, being around for 6,000 years. They're very tied to the idea of the environment and the environment that, you know, they come from. I think all those things are something the left usually avoids like the plague. And I think that's doomed a lot of really good, you know, very good people who just have bought into that idea of a kind of a secular, a secularism, meaning that you can't have any type of cultural pride. I mean, I don't think you should go fucking down the road of sipping lukewarm tea, what's the current room temperature fucking lager in England and kind of going around beating up immigrants. That's not English culture. But, you know, there's a person who used to do kind of join now and again on the podcast who was from the old kingdom of Mercia, and which probably appears in Crusader Kings. But you know, there is something to be said for kind of looking into history, looking into the culture, folklore. I mean, a lot of the really good English folk musicians like John Tams, who was in Sharp, if you remember Sharp from the 90s. He often was like, you know, organized and communicated a leftist message through his music. And I think the PKK has done that very, very well. And I think the left over here doesn't. I mean, Ireland, the Sinn Féin does it with, you know, the IRA stuff. But in England, we don't really see it, you know?
Well, I think there's, I mean, this is a topic for another podcast, but I've definitely talked about this on Sinan's stream before, maybe a couple of times, but it's definitely about the difference between, say, like Scottish nationalism and English nationalism. It's the Scottish nationalism defines itself by what it's not, and English nationalism doesn't have that, and so it's sort of more like a rabid dog, where, you know, Scottish nationalism can go like, well, that's not what they're doing. We want to do the opposite of that, and so, you know, it's Turkish nationalism, like English nationalism, is quite toxic. And so if you're opposing against that, you're obviously going to take opposing views, you know, sometimes for the right reasons, but sometimes just out of arbitrary reasons. But that still, you know, plays in your favor after a while. I think another thing that you can learn from them as a group as well is their adaptation, you know. And that's like all the groups that failed that we're talking about, that's where they went wrong. It happened to the Tamil Tigers. It happened to the Black Panthers. It was their inability to adapt to the situations that were put in front of them. And that's, you know, where the left fall down very often, is this failure to, you know, reassess the ground that they're on and just like change the terrain, like stop playing to the tune of the enemy. You know, the left in the UK is purely a reactionary force, and it does us no good. We should be the force that causes the government to react and the press to react. Like, we should be the ones that have been doing so, not always constantly in the back foot.
Like Nigel Farage did in a rather perverse way on the right.
No, but that's the perfect example, because he's, you know, he's never had a seat in Westminster, and he's the most successful politician of his generation. And all he was ever is an MEP. And that's because he was proactive rather than react. With that rounding...
I agree.
just like basically finishing this episode with praise of Nigel Farage. You'd never think you'd hear an anarchist podcast. I think we're going to call it tonight. So thanks to our guest, Sinan. Am I getting it right there?
Yeah, you got it right. Thank you very much for having me.
I think it's the S-I, obviously, in Irish is a sh sound.
Yeah, I've had a lot of Irish people do that exact pronunciation.
So yeah, I kind of just like, you do it without thinking about it. And yeah, hopefully I'll be back in your stream at some point soon as well.
Oh, definitely.
And goodbye to Alex, the great co-host of the show.
Bye. I am going to put clothes on now because it's not as hot.
It's very hot on his boat, listeners. That's not, he doesn't just get very excited about the PKK.
It's a bit like a oven, and I'm a bit like Sylvia Plath.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Hi. What a way to end a podcast.